This event benefits the First Unitarian Universalists for Peace and will take place on Wednesday, January 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Universalist Center, 1187 Franklin Street in San Francisco. This event is wheelchair accessible. For details, call 415-595-7306.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
This is Steve Zeltzer, and happy MLK Day today, this morning. Work Week this morning will look at the issue of income inequality, our social system and political alternatives with Ralph Nader and possibly Cindy Sheehan. Next, we will look at the role of Veolia Transportation and their water privatization policies throughout the world and how they affect people in Northern California. We will talk with United Steelworkers Boston School bus driver, fired union leader, and former President Gary Murchison and Nancy Murray from Boston, who has been fighting Veolia Transportation, which was seeking a transit contract. We will next examine the growing crisis for injured workers and what has happened to them under legislative bill SB 863. We will be joined by Dr. Robert Wyman, past president of AFSCME's Physicians Union, and Mitch Seaman, who is a legislative advocate with the California Federation of Labor. We will also hear the music of troubadour Carol Denny, who sings about the struggle and successful fight for freedom of Archie Lee, who was brought to California as a slave. Now to the news.
I'm Cameron Jones with news headlines, sitting in for Eileen Alfandary. An unexpected last-minute UN invitation for Iran to attend a peace conference on Syria threw the talks into doubt today, with the Syrian opposition saying it would pull out unless Secretary General Ban Ki-moon withdraws his offer. Iran is the main foreign backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and its presence has been one of the most contentious issues looming over the first talks attended by both Assad's government and opponents, set to start on Wednesday in Switzerland. Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign policy chief, says she welcomes the initiative of inviting Iran to talks this week in Geneva.
We have always said that we will support the United Nations and Lakhdar Brahimi in their decisions about participation. They have to weigh up the importance of having people present.
Adding to difficulties over the talks, Assad said he might seek re-election this year, effectively dismissing any talk of negotiating his departure from power, his enemy's main demand. In response, Syria's main opposition body, the National Coalition, said it will not attend the talks unless the UN retracts the invitation. Ban Ki-moon said today that there were heated discussions underway following the opposition's threat to pull out of talks. Ban said he'll have more on the situation later in the day. Iran has halted its most sensitive nuclear activity under a deal with world powers that paves the way for the easing of some sanctions. Western states were expected to ease sanctions later today after the United Nations nuclear watchdog confirmed Iran is meeting its end of the bargain under an interim accord to resolve a decade-old dispute over its nuclear program. European Union foreign ministers meeting in Brussels voted today to also suspend some sanctions. The mutual concessions are scheduled to last 6 months, during which time six powers, the U.S., Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany, aim to negotiate a final accord defining the future of Iran's nuclear activity. Seven bomb explosions killed 26 people and wounded dozens more in the Iraqi capital today. Police and medics say security forces battled Sunni Muslim militants around the western cities of Fallujah and Ramadi. No group claimed responsibility for the blasts, but Sunni insurgents, some of them linked to al-Qaeda, are widely blamed for a surge in violence in the past year. Civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. is being remembered today on the federal holiday of his 85th birthday. Parades, marches, and service projects are planned nationwide. A celebration will take place today from 10 a.m. to noon at Oakland's McClymonds High School. Among the speakers will be educator Shakti Butler and theologian Matthew Fox. KPFA spoke with organizer Aisha Clotley about today's event and the legacy of Dr. King.
As we know, Dr. King's work was facilitated by millions of people, and we believe that this is America's most important holiday, because right now we're leaving education behind for many black and brown kids across the nation. And so the work, it still has to be done.
Today's event in honor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s 85th birthday takes place at McClyman's High School in Oakland, 2607 Myrtle Street at 10 a.m. In Oregon, the audience at a Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration in Beaverton gasped when they heard about Oregon's history of black exclusion laws. The Reverend William Sinkford of the First Unitarian Church of Portland spoke yesterday at a Southminster Presbyterian church. The Oregonian reports that Sinkford said the laws passed by the territorial legislature starting in 1844 are one reason Oregon is one of the whitest states in the country. Sinkford says the exclusion laws were passed to keep black people out of Oregon in an attempt to avoid the controversy surrounding slavery. The audience gasped when he said blacks who refused to leave were to receive whippings twice a year. Chinese naval vessels, including an island landing ship, are staging drills in the South China Sea, where China and several other nations are locked in territorial disputes. The official Xinhua news agency says two destroyers and China's largest amphibious landing craft left the naval base on the southern island province of Hainan today. The ships also boast three helicopters and a company of Marines. A Vietnamese court has sentenced 30 people to death for trafficking heroin at the conclusion of a mass trial. State media reports that 21 men and 9 women were convicted today of being part of a ring that smuggled nearly 2 tons of heroin from Laos into Vietnam and then on to China. The trial lasted 20 days and was held in the northern province of Quang Ninh. Vietnam has tough drug laws, and possessing or trafficking as little as 22 ounces of heroin can result in a death sentence. President Barack Obama says he doesn't think marijuana is more dangerous than alcohol. Obama doesn't argue for legalizing pot, but he says in an interview with The New Yorker that pot is less dangerous than alcohol, quote, in terms of its impact on the individual consumer, end quote. The president has acknowledged using pot when he was young and calls it, quote, a bad idea. He says he's troubled that poor kids, many of them African American and Latinos, are far more likely to get locked up for smoking pot than middle class kids. But Obama urges a cautious approach, saying people who think legalizing pot will solve social problems are, quote, probably overstating the case. And weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny with a high of 70 degrees. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, partly cloudy with highs in the low 70s. I'm Cameron Jones. The Morning Mix is next.
This is Steve Zeltzer, and this is Work Week. Today we commemorate the anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King's long-time struggle, not only for equality, but living wages for workers in the United States. In fact, he was assassinated while supporting the AFSCME unionized sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, who were on strike for better wages and conditions. He organized marches for human and labor rights and also, to the anger of many liberals, opposed the Vietnam War. He called for an equal distribution of the wealth and resources. He saw that only a redistribution of resources could correct racial and economic injustice. As he took up the struggle for equality in the Poor People's Campaign, he faced the wrath of J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, who organized a full spying campaign of him. The FBI was fully aware of the threats against King and would, some have argued, were aware of his killer. The disparity of wealth in the United States has grown since King died, and in fact, the U.S. is still engaged in imperialist wars throughout the world, with over 700 bases and drone attacks murdering people throughout the world every day. The decline of living conditions for working people in the United States is growing. And in California, the richest state in the country, 24% live in poverty, and the African-American poverty rate is 36%. At the same time, California has 95 billionaires, and the Democrats have two-thirds control of the legislature. This morning, we will look at these issues with Ralph Nader. He has written to AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka to launch a national campaign for an increase in the minimum wage, And also possibly joining us might be Cindy Sheehan, who is running for governor of California as a candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for all your good work.
And happy Martin Luther King Day.
You too.
Now, Martin Luther King, as I said in my introduction, was fighting against income inequality in the United States before he was killed, the Poor People's March, and, of course, the fight for the workers and sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was killed, the AFSCME workers who were on strike for better wages and working conditions. It seems since his death that actually things have gotten worse in the United States.
Well, they definitely have, because in his last year, in the late 60s, American workers were making more than American workers make today at the minimum wage level. In other words, the federal minimum wage today is $7.25. It's a little higher in California, but not much. And the adjusted minimum wage from 1968 to now would be $10.75. 30 million workers are in that category, between $7.25 and $10.75. 30 million workers, 1 million Walmart workers, Target workers, dollar store workers, McDonald's workers, Burger Chef workers, are making less today than 1968, over 40 years ago. Even though the economists tell us repeatedly that worker productivity, largely due to automation, has doubled in the United States. So one Walmart worker today is doing the work of two Walmart workers in 1968, but is being paid less in real inflation-adjusted dollars than each of those two Walmart workers in 1968. The peak of wages in this country still is 1973 is the highest real inflation-adjusted wage in the history of the United States. It's been downhill ever since, with little wiggles up and down.
And isn't it the case, Ralph, that in fact many of these workers, Walmart workers, McDonald's workers, I know even workers who work at the ballpark who are members of Local 2, the Giants ballpark, they are getting, had to be subsidized and subsidized housing and food stamps. Is that the case that the government is actually, we're the public, are actually subsidizing workers because companies won't pay them a decent wage?
Yeah, that's what led conservative activist Ron Unz to start qualifying an initiative on the California ballot for this November to take California workers to $12 an hour over 3 years. And that's going to qualify, and he has a record of winning. Ron Unz, UNZ, watch his activity. You'll see the petitioners around California gathering the signatures in the next 3 months. And why is he doing this as a conservative? Because of the point you just made, that the taxpayers are being forced to subsidize the wages of repressed Walmart, Target, and other workers by a large margin. There was a House committee report, House Education Committee report recently that said every Walmart store is being subsidized every year for $1 million to $2 million in taxpayer money. What does that mean? That means that Walmart, and they've done this consciously with their workers, advise their workers how to go on housing assistance, fill out the forms for Medicaid, food stamps, earned income credit. In other words, the head of Walmart, who makes $11,000 an hour plus benefits, just think of that, an hour, 8 hours a day, plus benefits and perks, is basically saying to you, the taxpayer, we're not going to pay a 1968 inflation-adjusted wage to our workers because we want you, the taxpayers, to subsidize it so that the Walton family can be the richest family once again in the United States. So how do you turn this around? It's so easy, Steve. I'll let you ask me the question.
Okay. Well, I mean, it sounds like socialism for the rich. I mean, when we're the taxpayer paying for these billionaires.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things about Martin Luther King, and this is commemoration of his day, is he organized a Poor People's March And today, with the massive poverty you have in the United States, pauperization of young people with students, there are no marches, no mass marches. Now, you've written to Richard Trumka. I believe you've written him three letters, who's president of the AFL-CIO. What are you trying to say to him when you write him these letters, and why has there been no response?
Well, what I'm trying to say to him, and I've said it to him personally two, 3 years ago, is that the AFL-CIO has a great website urging a living wage, but it doesn't put resources. It doesn't put organizers on the ground in congressional districts. It doesn't put ads on TV as they do in the tens of millions of dollars every election campaign for the Democratic Party, which is also sluggish on this issue. The Democrats could win the House back and keep the Senate on this issue alone, because there are 30 million workers that would realize that the Democratic Party meant something to them before the vote in November. The SEIU union is putting some money behind these demonstrations that we're reading about and watching on TV in front of McDonald's and Burger King and the Walmart chain. And just a few thousand of these workers, together with what we've been doing in Washington and around the country, you can look at our website at timeforaraise.org for details. Just a few thousand people, plus what a few groups are doing, has made this almost the top number one or two issue in the coming weeks. Well, even Barack Obama is going to highlight the minimum wage increase necessity, not as high as we would like, in his coming State of the Union speech before Congress in a few days.
Well, Ralph, we're speaking with Ralph Nader, who has campaigned for president a number of times, and also he has taken up the fight for the increase in the minimum wage. But isn't it the case that President Obama could raise the, for example, wages, minimum wages of contract workers in the United States with a stroke of a pen, and yet he is not doing that? Why isn't he doing it? If he's talking about raising the minimum wage, why isn't he just, you know, with a stroke of a pen, raising the wages of these workers who work as contractors for the federal government?
Because he, contrary to his December 3rd speech, he doesn't feel it in the fiber of his character and personality. He has no skin in the game, and he's never resonated, regardless of his community organizing early background, with poor people.
But he's got a bust of Martin Luther King in his office, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, that's symbolism, right? That's good politics without reality behind it. And there have been demonstrators in front of the White House. Maybe he'll do that now in his State of the Union. I know there's some ferment inside the White House, but I think for your listeners, what Steve is referring to is a lot of the government activities in Washington are contracted out to private corporations, you know, like General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, etc. And a lot of the janitorial work and the security work in Washington and the federal buildings are contracted out, cafeterias, for example. And these companies are paying barely the minimum wage, which is way behind 1968. And so what Steve is saying is that Barack Obama doesn't have to wait for Congress on this. He could raise the wages of over a million federal contracting workers by an executive order today, tomorrow. And we hope that he'll say he's going to do it in his State of the Union. But keep the pressure on. Give the White House a call.
Well, we just had a budget agreement, which I understand actually cut the wages of federal workers by increasing their cost for pensions for newly hired federal workers. So it seems like they're going in the opposite direction. And in California, where you have 95 billionaires, it seems like the Democrats, who have two-thirds control of the legislature, aren't really making these kind of changes for working people to benefit them.
That's for sure. And Governor Jerry Brown has signed a bill to increase the minimum wage to $10 over a short time in California. But I think he should put more pressure on the Democratic Party and the state legislatures for these things, because California, do you know how California has the highest poverty rate in the country? I mean, most people don't know that. It's even higher than some of the states in the South. And, you know, people think it's the golden state, but there's a lot of poverty in California. But as I say, if workers would just get out in the streets and start demonstrating like some of them have been doing, a few thousand, what if there was a couple million? What if they picked one day for a living wage day and went out in the streets? You can't believe how that reverberates back on Capitol Hill in Congress.
Well, even a mass
fingers to the wind.
Even a mass rally or march of all the low-paid workers in the United States, minimum wage day, you could have a million workers easily in Washington, D.C., but it seems like that's not part of the agenda of the AFL-CIO to bring a million workers, poor people, to Washington, as Martin Luther King did with the Poor People's March.
Yeah, well, I think the AFL-CIO building in Washington should be picketed by union workers who want to expand the union movement by doing something for 30 million workers and making them more willing and more able to fight at their workplace level to unionize.
Yeah, and we'll see with this TPP fight on the January 31st, there will be demonstrations all over the hemisphere against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I'm part of an organizing committee and asking if there's going to even be a mass protest in Washington, D.C., where all these unions have their headquarters. That will be interesting to see. Will actually mobilize their own members in Washington, D.C. around TPP?
Well, I think the AFL-CIO, you know, is full of people in the building whose checks never bounce and they're doing very well, good pensions, insurance, good wages inside the AFL-CIO building. I think they're pushable. When you look outside the building, and we picketed the AFL-CIO the same day we picketed the Chamber of Commerce for different reasons on the living wage and minimum wage. And they looked out the window, but there weren't enough. And if the workers themselves would picket the AFL-CIO, you would see movement. It's a lot easier than we think, Steve. I'm telling you. When you're dealing with 30 million workers who are going to get a wage, and under the Ron Unz initiative, they're going to get up to $5 an hour more. And that, I mean, just imagine a few hours work, signing the petition, getting out and demonstrating, having good signs. It works.
Well, that's,
and you know, the two leaders of the Democratic Party in the House are from San Francisco. That's George Miller and Nancy Pelosi, and they could galvanize their party this year. As I keep telling them, they could win the House back and have few excuses for why these budgets are cut for ordinary people, while the big military budget and the corporate welfare budget are humming along at record levels.
And that's another issue that Martin Luther King brought up, the military and the role of imperialism in the military around the world. Well, I want to thank you for joining us this morning, Ralph, and talking about the fight for injured work for the poor in this country, who Martin Luther King fought for. And also, you are also have run for office. Why isn't there a political alternative in this country from the Democrats? I mean, it seems that there's a lot of disenchantment. A lot of people don't vote. What do you see about building an alternative in this country for the mass of people who aren't getting political representation?
Well, I'd take anything. I'd take even an enlightened billionaire. I'd take third-party candidates like Cindy Sheehan running for governor. We got to give more choices and voices to the voters on the ballot, new agendas, anything to shake up the two-party tyranny. And let me just leave the last phrase for your listening audience. Repeat, it's easier than we think if we get off from our chairs and start demonstrating and demanding. It's easier than we think. Check out our action website, timeforaraise.org. We're going to win this fight, by the way. And wouldn't people want to say in the future that they were part of this massive drive toward a living wage?
Now, you've been on MSNBC, and that's where I saw you last time, and they've been giving you some play. Do you think you're getting more media coverage around this issue of a living wage and the situation for poor in the United States?
Yeah, well, believe it or not, after 5 years of urging, the so-called liberal talk show hosts on minimum wage are starting to stir, but it still hasn't reached Chris Matthews, and they should all stir. I mean, their counterparts are running ahead of them. Bill O'Reilly came out for a minimum wage increase to $10.10.
That's Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah. And he's on Fox News. And by the way, Phyllis Schlafly, in her 90s, has just come out, the conservative, for a higher minimum wage to reduce welfare spending.
But you're saying that even these right-wingers are saying that there should be a minimum wage increase. But it seems like the Democratic Party, which controls in California, the legislature has two-thirds. I mean, do you need an initiative in California when the Democrats have two-thirds control of the legislature? They could pass it themselves. I mean, isn't that strange, Ralph, that the Democrats who have two-thirds control of the legislature couldn't just pass a wage increase for the workers of California?
Well, they did, up to $10 over years. That's not enough because it doesn't even catch up with 1968. But that's why the Governor Hiram Johnson in California over 100 years ago, or about 100 years ago, established the initiative referendum recall in California so the people could become their own legislatures and vote it in. And that's what Ron Unz is going to do in November. Wait and see.
And I think that's under the attack in the legislature. Now, why isn't it that the unions aren't really kind of mobilizing to get their membership to have an initiative or to demand that there be a $15 wage increase? I know the San Francisco Labor Council just passed a resolution supporting the $15 an hour wage, minimum wage, and yet it seems like it's not on the agenda in California as it is in other states.
Well, the California Nurses Association, Oakland, they're for a higher minimum wage. They can certainly galvanize on that. And second, you know, most unions don't resonate with the minimum wage because their workers are making quite a bit more than minimum wage. But if they keep not resonating, the workers are going to have their wages cut, so they're going to have to resonate with workers. Already in California, supermarket workers are making not very much wages in these chains. So this is a great cause for the unions. The SEIU has done something, as I said, the California nurses. They need to get together and really push the legislature and Jerry Brown. There's no state in the union that has a higher percentage of Democrats controlling the state legislature together with a progressive governor who knows what the score is, Jerry Brown. So really? It takes a civic jolt. That's what I call it, civic jolt. Okay. Once they hear from the people, they'll start moving.
Okay, well, I want to thank you again for joining us. It's been Ralph Nader, and he's joined us this morning on Work Week, so thanks, and happy Martin Luther King Day, Ralph.
Thank you. Thanks.
Now we have another guest, a musician with us, Carol Denny, and she also is a host with TwitWit, which is a show on KPFA. And Carol, you heard about a story of a slave, Archie Lee, who was brought to California. Why don't you talk about that?
Oh,
welcome to the show.
I'm glad to. Happy Martin Luther King Day, and thanks for having me. Yeah, this is such a great story, and I think you're the one that first turned me on to it. It was a story that started back in 1857 when California was a state, all right, but it was before the Civil War, and it was a free state, unlike Mississippi. So these Charles Stovall came out to California and brought a slave with him. And so you could have a slave with you in California if you were planning to go back to Mississippi. But Charles Stovall basically set up to live in California. And Archie Lee looked around. He saw, well, this is what I figure. I always see this as a movie. He looks around. He sees free black men conducting their own lives, living independently, working, getting paid. He's not getting paid a dime for all of his free labor. And he decides to make a change. So he goes down to what was then a rooming house owned by free black men, the Hackett House, and decides he's going to live there as a free man. So, of course, Charles Stovall sent police down to get him, and thus began a carnival of court cases. The first went against Charles Stovall, and Archie Lee was declared free. Then it went, you know, the Democratic-controlled courts and legislature decided they would revisit the issue, and then it went back to the slaveholder. And then it turned around again, finally, because there was a revolt, and San Franciscans stood up for Archie Lee's freedom.
And the California Supreme Court at that time was run by Democrats who were in favor of segregation, so they believe that Stovall should have control and ownership of Archie Lee. So you've written a song. This is the first time you're going to hear it on the air.
That's
actually,
right.
And KPFA is the only station that you're going to hear this song on.
Pretty much.
So, Carol, let's hear that song.
Stovall Lee set off for California. Stovall was a white man and Lee was a slave. Archie Lee decided to be free in California, saying, I'm off to Hackett. Ticket House to get me a shave. They came from Mississippi, where slavery was legal. California was a free state before the Civil War. A man could have a slave if heading back to Mississippi, but Stovall came out west to stay and set up store. You couldn't trust the courts back in 1857. Just like today, they don't always know the score. Archie Lee was freed because all of us are equal. San Francisco worked it out without a civil war. Stovall sent police down to Hackett House to get him. Stovall told police Lee was his property. But Hackett House was owned by smart black free men who hired a couple lawyers bound to set him free. The first judge agreed that Lee should be a free man, but a second writ was issued putting Lee back in jail. And this time the courts reversed its decision, said Stovall could still own a man if he'd set sail. You couldn't trust the courts back in 1857. Just like today, they don't always know the score. Archie Lee was freed because all of us are equal. San Francisco worked it out without a civil war. The story went round the streets of San Francisco. The people were taken by the tale of Archie Lee. They gathered in patrols by land and on water, determined to make sure no man was property. The young and the old men and women together stormed the Orizaba, taking Archie out to sea. A third round of courts, and the case was finally settled, and thanks to San Franciscans, Archie Lee was finally free. You couldn't trust the courts back in 1857. Just like today, they don't always know the score. Archie Lee was freed because all of us are equal. San Francisco worked it out without a civil war. San Francisco worked it out without a civil war.
Thank you, Carol. That was a beautiful song. And if you want to know more about this story, Lauren Shoup has written a book called Rulers and Rebels, and that's where I first heard about that story, which is a tremendous story. And thanks for bringing it to us on KPFA this morning on Work Week. Thank you, Carol. Zeltzer with Workweek Radio on the commemoration of Martin Luther King. One of the goals of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is to force privatization of public services throughout the world. In Korea, railroad workers are fighting privatization of Korail, and there will be a general strike on February 25th. In the recent Bay Area BART struggle, the BART Board of Directors hired Thomas P. Hawk, who is vice president of Veolia Corporation. He demanded givebacks, including a wage cut, so BART workers could help pay for new rail cars. A Veolia Transportation Company was also contracted to take commuters for free when the workers struck. And in today's Chronicle, there's a long story about the millions of dollars the BART Board of Directors paid to the Veolia Corporation. While the struggle was taking place, the Veolia Company, which took over the Boston School Bus Drivers contract, was also attacking United Steelworkers Local 8751. After a contract, four union leaders were fired and are still fighting for their jobs back. Also, a struggle has been made to oppose Veolia getting contracts for transit and water operations throughout the U.S. and internationally. Activists were recently successful in stopping Veolia from getting a $4 billion contract with the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, MBTA, and Massachusetts Department of Transportation, MassDOT, in part because of Veolia's role in providing segregated transportation in Palestine and in supporting transit for more settlements. Joining us this morning is Nancy Murray, who is a member of the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, has been educating people around Veolia nationally and internationally, and United Steelworkers 8751 school bus driver and former union president Gary Murchison, who is one of the union leaders that has been fired by Veolia. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you.
Now, Gary, you're a bus driver in Boston, and you've had some personal experience about Veolia, which runs the Boston school bus system. What were your experiences with this company, Veolia?
Well, we all believed since day one, before Veolia got here, what the concept of the Boston public schools' intentions were. And that was more so that's come to bus our union. And up until today, which is on Martin Luther King's birthday, there's still concept is to more so to try to bust us by keeping the union leaders that are out of work right now out of work. They have no intention of moving. They have no intention of putting us back to work. They want to more so put us through the process of grievance process, which they never answered any of our other grievances, which we have 175 grievances that they haven't responded to.
And do you think this has anything to do with the treatment of black and Latino drivers? A lot of the school bus drivers, a lot of bus drivers in this country are black and Latino, are a minority. Is there a racial component in their attacks on the school bus drivers?
Of course it is. The majority of our drivers are 85% are of color. And the 85% is our Haitian descent. And the rest is up. Latino, Hispanic, black, and Caucasian.
And the unions there in Boston have been mobilizing, and there's going to be a conference here on February 8th at the Mission Cultural Center. Steve Ellis Gillis is coming, who's a vice president of the local. What kind of support have you received from the rest of the labor movement around the issue of the attack on your rights and conditions?
Well, we have, as of today, we've still out that put an outreach to other unions and other locals. And as of last week, we had the endorsement of the AFL-CIO by the president. We also have the steelworkers behind us. We also have IBEW Local 2222. And we have other locals that are now coming on board because of we had Solidarity Day on November the 9th. I don't know if you know that, and we also have another Solidarity Day on February the 1st for the 4.
So you're going to be having a Solidarity Day for your struggle to get your jobs back. And are you also trying to kick Veolia out of having a contract with the school bus system? And where does the new mayor of Boston, who is a former union official, stand in relationship to this?
Well, as of right now, we are still in the process of trying to deal with Veolia and how they've been conducting business, not only with our local, but with the community also. As of trying to get them to lose the contract, of course we've been trying to get them to look into Veolia's contract. The city councilors had a hearing not too long ago on Veolia's, how they've been conducting business and how they more interact with us on February the 8th. That hearing took place, and they rescheduled the hearing because the city council, Charles Yancey, called the hearing, and they called for us to be there, Veolia to be there, the mayor to be there, the school department to be there. And no one showed up at the hearing. They just sent a letter disrespecting the city councils. And they rescheduled a hearing, and now they sent out a 7F, which is sort of like, what's the word? Like it's like a subpoena.
I see.
So, like, they subpoenaed the mayor this time, Veolia, and the school department.
Okay, thank you. We're speaking with Gary Murchison. He's the past president of the school bus drivers in Boston, and they're fighting for their jobs back. They're fired union leaders. And also joining us is Nancy Murray, who's a member of the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights. And, Nancy, you've been also battling Veolia, it seems, and had a recent success in Massachusetts. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, I will talk about that. Thanks very much for the invitation to be on your show. I can't say that the coalition that came together called Derail Veolia Accountability Coalition really was the responsible for this contract, which is worth as much as $4.2 billion, being taken away from Veolia. But we certainly helped raise consciousness about what it is doing, both in Massachusetts and around the world. Let me just say that Veolia was one of three organizations that ran the commuter rail, but it did the actual work of running the rail and had the biggest stake in what was called the Massachusetts Bay Commuter Railroad. And back in 2006, a newspaper headline basically referred to the MBCR, the Massachusetts Commuter Bay Commuter Railroad, as, quote, successful model for privatization, because for it had a contract lasting 10 years to run the fifth largest railroad system in the United States. And, you know, a lot of us were very alarmed by Veolia's role in privatizing water and privatizing waste, by its union bashing, and the fact that they were in to get a new contract, it seemed, to run the commuter rail was very concerning. It seemed they had that, you know, more or less sewn up because they had a lot of insider dealing with the Massachusetts legislators and Massachusetts Department of Transportation and so on. So we did a real public relations campaign pointing out not just what Veolia was doing in terms of human rights abuses. It has been the subject of a huge international campaign because it has helped sustain the Israeli occupation of the West Bank by running these buses to settlements. It finally sold its bus lines after a lot of pressure just last year, also being responsible for operating the Jerusalem light rail system, which serviced illegal settlements, and for running a dump in the occupied territories for Israeli waste, all of which is illegal under international law.
And your campaign there, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up, but you have been organizing around that, and this success, do you think this is going to spread against Veolia around the world?
Well, yes, it already is. I mean, there's a huge international campaign that has cost Veolia over $20 billion in contracts before this decision. And again, I can't say that we were responsible for the decision to award it to another company, the new contract. But certainly, I think that now the more the public learns about what Veolia is doing, both in international human rights terms, in the occupied territories of West Bank, Palestinian territories, and in terms of all of its other transgressions, which are written about at length. You could find this information on the website.
What's your website?
Well, all sorts of websites. Globalexchange.org, whoprofits.org. There's a list on Global Exchange of all the lost contracts, Veolia, where there have been campaigns against Veolia and they've lost contracts. That whole list you could find. It's both contracts that have been lost in the United States and around Europe. It's trade unions standing up against getting new contracts in England and other places. All of that information is there.
Okay, we've been speaking with Nancy Murray, who is with the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, and Gary Murchison, who is a driver in the Boston school buses. They're going to have a rally on February February 1st, and there's a conference on February the 8th at the Mission Cultural Center. You can go to their website on labor and Veolia, human rights and the environment. And Veolia was involved in privatizing the Richmond water treatment plant here in Richmond. So I want to thank you both for coming on and letting us know on Martin Luther King today about the fight for human rights and the role of Veolia in that struggle. So thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Gary. California injured workers have been under attack for decades by business and insurance companies who claim they are costing too much money. Under former Governor Schwarzenegger, a bill called SB 899 was passed that cut permanent disability by 50% and even prevented injured workers from getting acupuncture. Under Governor Brown, another bill was passed called SB 863, which increased permanent disability compensation, but also limited compensation for psychological injuries after a physical injury. Recently, there was a hearing in the Division of Workers' Compensation in Oakland, and injured workers spoke about some of their issues. Joining us this morning is Dr. Robert Wyman, former president of AFSCME Local 206, Union of American Physicians and Dentists, who now does work with injured workers, and Mitch Seaman, who is a legislative advocate with the California Federation of Labor. Welcome to the show, both of you, this morning.
Thank you very much.
Rob Wyman here.
Dr. Wyman, you have been involved in representing or doing reports for injured workers, and you've been involved in the labor movement as well. What has happened to injured workers in California?
They have become progressively disenfranchised since SB 899. For example, although it is true that SB 863 gave back some permanent disability, actually it allowed a lot of permanent disability initially sought by the California Federation of Labor to be disqualified later, so that they gave back some of the permanent disability in exchange for certain restrictions on workers. So it looks like they had a double loss after what seemed like an initial win. So what happens now is injured workers submit claims. These claims are denied. The doctors don't get paid, so they quit the program. This is fine for the insurance companies because the money still runs in as premiums but doesn't have to be paid out. Next, when you make a complaint about a legitimate claim, the injured worker's attorney or the injured worker himself and their treating doctor is told that, oh, we can't pay that, it's a duplicate claim, or, oh, we can't pay that, you didn't do the paperwork properly. An investigation of this has shown that these allegations are false 80% of the time, but no penalties are hit against Maximus and the other insurance companies who do workers' comp. The only people penalized are treating doctors and their injured workers.
And we're speaking with Dr. Robert Wyman. He's a doctor who handles injured workers in California. Also joining us is Mitch Seaman, who is with the California Federation of Labor. Mitch, what's your view on what's going on with injured workers in California?
Well, I think the first and most important thing to mention is where the system was 2 years ago prior to Senate Bill 863, that we were in a situation where it really was all starting to collapse. The costs had started to skyrocket, but a lot of that wasn't translating into improved outcomes or better medical treatment for workers. That, in fact, more and more of the money was being lost to waste, fraud, delays, different kinds of profiteering within the system. And so that was one of the main things that we tried to do, was both deal with some of the delays that were causing 6 months, a year of delay for workers who were simply trying to get resolution on medical treatment questions, in addition to the attacks on permanent disability benefits that were a part of Senate Bill 899 in 2004. So in those two respects, Senate Bill 863 has been an incredible success. We raised permanent disability benefits by almost 30% for permanently injured workers. The delays now are, they go through a totally different process called IMR, as the doctor mentioned, that gets resolution on claims much faster. We saw in that presentation last week that they're down to about 48.2 days. as far as the amount of time that it takes for workers to get those treatment questions answered. So we're in a much, much better position than we were 2 years ago. Now, it's not to say that the system works perfectly, and there will always be room for further reforms and further tweaks as time goes on, but that it's critical to remember that we really were looking at a system that was about to collapse in on itself 2 years ago, and we were able to identify almost $1 billion in savings and new revenue, most of which was transferred back into new permanent disability benefits for injured workers. So, you know, we think a lot of the reforms that happened, but, of course, we're always open to new ideas for reform if those do come up.
And you're hearing Mitch Seaman, and he's with the California Federation of Labor and Legislative Advocate. Now, Mitch, there has been reports of increasing use of opiates, of pain drugs for injured workers causing addiction in California. Are you concerned about the fact that the use of these opiates is because workers are not getting the treatment that they need quickly and instead being given drugs for their injuries?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem both in the California workers' comp system and across the country in all healthcare systems. It's especially become pronounced over the last few years. But that was one of the main reasons that we focused on treatment delays as much as we did, that we saw this huge problem with workers waiting around months and months to get the treatment that they needed, spending more and more time on opiates and developing addiction issues. And so it's something that we're definitely going to be looking at in the future. As far as what the best solution looks like, we really can't say, but it is something that we're very concerned about.
Needs to be pointed out, Bob Wyman.
Dr. Wyman,
it needs to be pointed out that insurance companies consistently and flagrantly failed to comply with DWC regulations, Department of Workers' Comp regulations. Many insurance agents and their companies and their defense attorneys end up denying injured workers access to treatment other than opiates. They let the opiates get prescribed because it's cheaper to have a person walk in and out of a doctor's office. And if the only thing that the doctor can do is to prescribe pain medication, of course, he has to do that because he's got to do something when all the alternative treatments have been refused by the insurance companies, which is what is happening now. The idea that the IBR takes only 48 days is completely erroneous. It's a maximus statistic. In other words, it's an insurance company statistics. What is really happening is that insurance companies and their agents have demonstrated a clear practice of incorrect bill processing with injured workers bearing the brunt of it and running out of temporary disability after 2 years, which is the aim of the current program.
Okay, well, we were at the hearing that was held, the Division of Workers' Compensation, and a nurse was involved in speaking about the problem she is having, and we're going to listen to her. She gave some comments at that hearing, so why don't we go to that tape.
Ms. Sarah Hames Anderson. I am a nurse. Until October of this year, I was working full-time.
What happened to your work?
Actually, I was injured in 1999 lifting a patient at a local hospital up in Northern California where I work, and I tore my ribs off my spine by tearing the joint capsules that hold them together and tore a bunch of muscles in my left shoulder. It's been a battle to find a treatment. I tried literally a dozen different narcotics, most of which I found out I'm allergic to. The last narcotic that I was on, which was in 2004, caused my adrenal system to shut down completely. So we found a treatment regimen that works that consists of injections of trigger points and Botox, no opioid medications. And I've been stable on that treatment for 8 years, working full-time.
And what happened there?
And since the new law changed...
Which law was that?
When SB 863 came in July and impacted all the previous cases that had been settled or adjudicated, they decided that the four QMEs and two WCAB hearings that I had had already addressing medical necessity for the treatment no longer applied. So now they have picked apart my treatment regimen. I am back on opioid medications. I am on state disability. And
well, why are you on state disability? This was an injury that was done that you should be covered by.
Because they took away the care that was helping.
But state disability doesn't pay medical care, do they?
But no, but they're paying because I can't work right now. So I'm off work temporarily until I can hopefully get stable enough to go back to work because I just want to work. I have a full-time job.
So you had a treatment that was working?
Correct. For the better part of a decade. 8 years.
And with this new law, SB 863, they said it's no longer applicable.
No longer applicable, and the four QMEs that I'd been through, and the two judges' hearings at the WCAB no longer apply.
And did you contact this agency?
I did.
And what was happening?
I got no response. I called the information assistance line multiple times, sat on hold for hours and hours on end. The only way I ever actually talked to an information assistance officer was when I made a complaint with the audit unit, and the guy at the audit unit called me to tell me to stop sending complaints because they weren't going to investigate, and said, I'm going to go across the hall and get somebody to talk to you. And the information assistance officer told me I should settle my case.
So he was giving you legal advice to basically capitulate to the insurance company.
He said, I can't really tell you this, but you should probably think about settling. They want me out of the system, and their information assistance officers are not going to help you. They are not there to inform you or assist you. They are there to support the insurance companies and the state.
Okay, that was a nurse who testified at the Department of Workers' Compensation or Division of Workers' Compensation. Now, Mitch Seaman of the California Labor Federation and Dr. Robert Wyman. I mean, Mitch, it seems like this is a pretty serious issue that this nurse was was not able to continue to get non-opiate medication, but also she was told to settle her case. And there's this company called Maximus, which apparently has been paid $40 million by the state to do this work of deciding whether workers get workers' compensation, and their injuries taken care of. What do you think about the issue of Maximus and what they're doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, just to say to that worker, that sounds like that just sounds like a terrible injury. We're really sorry to hear that that happened to her. And there was nothing in 863 that was designed to take away treatment regimens. And if that is occurring, I can't really comment on the specific case, but if there are isolated examples out there where there is some sort of flaw in IMR where that's actually happening, we, of course, very much want to know about that. So, you know, we'd be very interested in talking to that specific worker. But
Bob Wyman, I can comment on that. That was part of the purpose of 863. It was made known to the people before it was passed, and the bill was passed because there was other exigencies in government that made a trade indicated, and CalFed folded on the injured workers. That's why it passed, and these intended consequences are happening as predicted and are not
That's not why the bill was passed.
Mitch, this issue of outsourcing, Maximus is a outside company, and they are in charge of determining whether workers get their health care. They have their own doctors that you have to be a member of their operation. Maximus was paid $40 million. The idea of outsourcing this determination of injured workers, do you think that that is a proper way of handling the situation of injured workers in California, giving it to a private company who makes money by basically denying medical care?
We think that sending these decisions to doctors makes a lot more sense than sending them to the Workers' Comp Appeals Board and letting judges make medical decisions about what sort of treatment's appropriate for injured workers. That, in addition to the fact that we reduce the amount of time that it takes to get resolution from 6 months to a year down to 48 days, absolutely makes this an appropriate way to deal.
It's not down to 48 days. Well, it's down to never days in example.
Okay, well, doctor,
as an example of the patient that you just heard from.
Well, Dr. Wyman, you have some experience with injured workers. Are you saying that this case that the nurse talked about is not an isolated case, but that there are more problems like that among injured workers in California?
Those cases are rife. And what happens when Maximus does its authority is Maximus says we are adhering to the guidelines, but over 80% of IBRs do not have decisions posted on or are found ineligible for IBR. So note that. They have an 80% failure rate, but they say those cases are ineligible for IBR review. Furthermore, did you know that IBR doctors do not have to be licensed in the state of California? If they commit something that's egregiously at fault, they cannot be evaluated by the California Medical Board. They
are not allowed to be IMR.
Be evaluated by their own state medical board, which doesn't have jurisdiction in California. And did you know that?
Investigated, they're not allowed to perform the service.
Well, Mitch Seaman, and that was Dr. Robert Wyman. Mitch Seaman with the California Labor Fed. I mean, the fact that you have anonymous doctors, and this is something that injured workers brought up, do you think that's of serious concern, that you have anonymous doctors making decisions on injured workers and you can't challenge them, basically? You don't know who the doctor is?
Well, the question then becomes, what would you plan to do with the information if you knew more about the doctor? I mean, they're under very strict statutory restrictions as far as what they can do, what their experience has to be, what sort of qualifications they have to have. So, yes, okay. We absolutely do think that makes sense.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both for joining us. This has been Work Week on Martin Luther King Day and Solidarity. And let's remember MLK in his struggle for human rights and justice. And Work Week will continue. Solidarity has no borders. And we also want to let you bye-bye. Thank you much.
You are tuned to KPFA or KPFB Berkeley. Or 88.1 KFCF in Fresno. Online at kpfa.org. Stay with us.